Welcome to City Arts and Lectures, a season of talks and onstage conversations with some of the most celebrated writers, artists, and thinkers of our day, recorded before an audience at the Sydney Goldstein Theater in San Francisco. This week, writer Rachel Kushner. She's the author of several novels, including The Flamethrowers and The Mars Room. Her work has drawn comparisons to Joan Didion's and that of Don DeLillo, a literary mentor to Kushner. Her newest book, The Hard Crowd, is a collection of essays from the past 20 years, showcasing her extraordinary intellect and diverse interests, from muscle cars and motorcycles to postmodern art and political movements. On April 29th, 2021, Rachel Kushner spoke to writer Heidi Julewitz about the art of writing and the places and people that inspire her. Join us now for a conversation with Rachel Kushner.
Hi, welcome everybody. My name is Heidi Julewitz, and I'm here tonight with the writer Rachel Kushner. We now have to do this somewhat awkward thing where I speak about her in the third person while she's right here next to me. And this is kind of like a wedding toast. So can you handle this for just like a second? And then we'll make it not awkward anymore. So I could spend the next hour speaking about why Rachel is that rare and valuable combination of the artistic, the intellectual, the political, the philosophical, how she writes all-consuming, page-turning, heartbreaking novels, how deep and wide and yet how uniquely Rachel are her interests, how she functions as a cultural consumer and cultural curator and cultural explorer and cultural deconstructor, and how her new book of essays, The Hard Crowd, is like a guidebook, scrapbook, epigraph, epitaph, eulogy, collecting 20 years worth of obsessions and interrogations and personal experiences, and in which readers can see the origins of her then future novels, Telex from Cuba, The Flamethrowers, and The Mars Room. But instead, for starters, Rachel, who's now a sort of second person, sort of third person, is going to demonstrate all of these qualities I've just listed and more by reading a bit from her new book, The Hard Crowd. Rachel, take it away.
Thanks, Heidi. I just want to say, I think the last time I saw you in person was in the penthouse of this at the El Cortez Casino in Las Vegas. The penthouse, which, as I understand it, was originally designed for the owner of the casino and had all these odd, bespoke, custom details in it, which I'm speaking to the audience now, which Heidi duly walked me through in a manner that emanated novelistic possibility and verve in every corner, from the light switches to the hidden bar to the pink. They were like on a trucker mud flap. The female silhouettes, I think, were featured all around the bathroom. And in any case, that was the last time I saw her, and I'm a long, long time fan of her work. We have spent little time together in person, but it always feels electric because her mind is very inspiring to me. I'm going to read just a couple pages from the title essay of this book, The Hard Crowd. It took me a long time to learn that word, eponymous. And then for the next many years, I was looking for ways to avoid using it because it's so awkward. But this is the eponymous essay in the book. And this part is, it's about a bar in San Francisco that no longer exists where I worked. It was my first bartending job at the Blue Lamp on Geary between Taylor and Jones. The owner of the Blue Lamp was named Bobby. I remember his golf cap and his white boat shoes and the broken purple capillaries on his face. The gallery of sad young women who tolerated him in exchange for money and a place to crash. Bobby's brother would drive his Harley right into the bar. Bobby lived out in the Excelsior, but the two brothers built an apartment upstairs from the Blue Lamp for especially wild nights. I never once went up there. It wasn't a place I wanted to see. Sometimes the swamper, Jer we all called him, slept up there when he knew Bobby wasn't coming around. But mostly Jer slept in the bar's basement, on an old couch next to the syrup tanks. Jer's life philosophy was, we'll work for beer. He restocked the coolers, fetched buckets of ice, mopped up after hours, drank 40 bottles of Budweiser a day, and only resorted to harder stuff on his periodic Greyhound trips to Sparks to play slots. That Jared preferred Sparks to Reno was one of the only things about himself that he vocalized. In addition to slots, Jared played video poker. We had a machine in the bar called Hot Point, which paid out to winners illegally in cash. Whole parts of Jer, I suspected, were missing, in some kind of permanent dormancy. I wondered who he'd been before he lived this repetitive existence, buckets of ice and Budweiser, day after day after day. He owned nothing. He slept in his clothes, slept even in his mesh baseball hat. I know. I saw. He lived at the bar and never went out of character. He was a drinker and a swamper. He said little, but it was me and him, day after day, night after night. A bartender and her barback are a kind of platonic pair, and Jer had my back literally. After 2 a.m. closings, he would come outside and watch me start my motorcycle, an orange Moto Guzzi I parked on its center stand on the sidewalk. He insisted I call the bar when I got home. I always did. I never wrote about most of the people from the Blue Lamp. If I transformed them into fiction, I might lose my grasp on the real place, the evidence of which has otherwise evaporated. The bar is gone. All those people have died. That might be why. Or perhaps a person can write about things only when she is no longer the person who experienced them, and that transition is not yet complete. The person who writes about her experience is not the same person who had the experience. The ability to write about it is proof of change, of great distance. Not everyone is willing to admit this, but it's true. In this sense, a conversion narrative is built into every autobiography. The writer purports to be the one who remembers, who saw, who did, who felt. But the writer is no longer that person. In writing things down, she is reborn, and yet still defined by the actions she took, even if she now distances herself. In all a writer's supposed self-exposure, her claim to authentic experience, the thing the writer omits reporting on is her galling idea that her life might become a subject put to paper, might fill the pages of a book.
Amazing. Thank you so much. I can't tell you how many emails I got after that was published in The New Yorker. Not because people thought I wrote it, but because I was like, thanks, guys. I'm glad you liked it. Because I lived out there roughly when the time you were talking about in this essay. And I feel like everybody felt that you had captured this time so well. And I think that's a sort of interesting way to think about it, that you captured the time. And I'm wondering, because you talk about like authenticity and stuff, did you have anybody challenging your authenticity? Like, did you have anyone coming out of the woodwork just being like, no, that wasn't how it was after you published it?
Oh, that, I love this question. There's a lot of things I want to say in response, if you don't mind. First, yes, like I'm not surprised to hear that. I mean, I guess I knew this from you directly, but I'm also just on instinct would know maybe that you had traversed the epic that I try to kind of bring back to life in a way, but from a great distance. After this piece from the book was excerpted in The New Yorker, almost whole cloth, not entirely, just for space. You know, I think the piece in the book is like, I don't know, 8,000 words, and The New Yorker took 6,500 words or something. It was almost all of it. After that piece appeared in The New Yorker, I got a lot of letters from people, more than anything I've ever written before in my life, in terms of the amount of response and the intensity of the response, almost entirely positive. I'll get to the one negative.
One's a pretty good ratio. That's a pretty good ratio, I have to say.
Well, maybe I'm a professional exaggerator, but if there was another, I can't remember it. But I think that I thought about like why that response was. I mean, one obvious reason is that the piece talks about a set of scenes and personalities and a way of life and a mindset in a city that is really gone, you know, and all of our histories are gone. I'm not making a critique of like the tech industry and the destruction of San Francisco, et cetera. Even if that's all real, it interests me less than, frankly, like my own life and the time that I lived through. And for every person what happened 30 years ago is no longer extant. And you knew people that you don't know now, whether they're living or not, they don't take up the same space in your mind. And I think that the age that I am and that the people who read that article and had a strong reaction to it are, is precisely an age when you start to move into a more reflective stage of life. I also think that, and this is just my theory, that the pandemic itself made people become more reflective and more willing to kind of tally and look at the past and think about and be occupied by other times that aren't this moment. So I think that people were eager to sort of, as I say at the end of the piece, as a kind of entreaty, you know, to bore me with their stories after I've bored them with mine. And some people like really took me up on that offer and wrote long pieces to me about their own history in San Francisco. And it was fine and it was cool because I felt suddenly like I was part of a collective project that I didn't necessarily need to have initiated or wasn't going to give myself credit for, but that had to do with kind of being stewards of the past with other people, whether I know them or not. So in terms of people taking issue with things, you know, as you know, when you publish something in the New Yorker, they assign fact checkers to it. I mean, even when it's fiction, if you refer to a real place and a real street, they're going to make sure that you, when you say, I looked west on Fulton Street, they're going to make sure that that street runs west, east, et cetera. With a nonfiction piece, they are going to attempt to fact check every single part of it. And this piece was sort of written in the, you know, in the dream of this. It's not a nostalgic reminiscence because a lot of what I conjure, I wouldn't want to live again. But it's nonetheless written inside of a sort of a bubble of my own very subjective life and experiences. So it's a little funny to have something like that fact checked. And so, but the fact checker called people like, you know, my friend Jeannie Hicks, who lived next door to me on 8th Avenue when we were kids, worked at Kentucky Fried Chicken in the Tenderloin on Eddie and Taylor. And I don't even mention her by name in the piece. I say the first of my friends who was older than the rest of us got her job at KFC, and I quickly followed in her footsteps and got my job at Baskin Robbins. And the New Yorker contacted this woman who I am still sort of in touch with, who lives in Bakersfield now, you know, with the, like, did you work at Kentucky Fried Chicken when you were 15? They contacted another friend of mine, you know, were you at an agnostic French show in 1992? Was there beer on the floor? Was there a fight? Was there this? Was there that? And my friends are like, I think so. I mean, I think some of what came out of that was just the creepiness that I had retained these granular details and memories of things that other people, it was more like in the wash of the past for them. And maybe that's because they hadn't dedicated themselves to trying to write it down. But like they contacted this guy, Not Human, who's a sound artist in San Francisco. I had never met him. He doesn't know me from Adam. But he was sitting in front of me at a Terrence McKenna lecture that I mentioned at the Palace of Fine Arts. So they call this guy, were you at a Terrence McKenna lecture at the Palace of Fine Arts in God knows what year? Yeah, I was. And, you know, you start to wonder, like, is this the FBI? Why are these people contacting me? So I mention the musician Harley Flanagan in that piece, who was in this band, the Cro-Mags. And his band toured a lot with my friend Alex Brown's band, Gorilla Biscuits. And there's a whole separate essay about Alex in the book because he's a really interesting person and also a friend of mine who died. But I say in the piece that this guy who was a Hare Krishna in Berkeley, who was covered with tattoos and was clearly in a hardcore band, either like moonlighting as a Hare Krishna from his hardcore life or the two were not in competition, I don't know. But he was not happy about his depiction. But then I sent the New Yorker his autobiography and they read it and it didn't conflict with anything that I said. And I had to make the difficult decision to upset this person and go ahead with the piece or what. But most people were really gracious about it. And I speak in detail about this guy, Freddie Corbin, mm-hmm. who is a tattoo artist in San Francisco, who's very well known and very beloved. Like, people call him Mr. Nice Guy, and it's for a reason. He's just truly a really nice guy. And I was roommates with him for a brief period of time, which I mentioned in that essay. And I really wanted Freddie to approve it. I wanted his blessing, because some of what I talk about is fairly heavy material, you know, regarding his brother and other people who died, who he was connected to. And he was really gracious about it. And he said, you know, we're artists and we're interested in the truth of art. And I, you know, give you my blessing to publish it. I mean, when the New Yorker contacted him, he said, well, when you say I had diamonds in my teeth, actually, I just had one diamond in my tooth. So then they had to remove an S and make it singular rather than plural. But there were a lot of situations where people would contact me and say, I remember that too. I remember this. And it became a kind of increasing responsibility that I felt once it was too late, that maybe by writing this down and fixing it in a way, like a photograph in the developing agent, now what I've presented to people, they could adopt as their own memory. And I, maybe that's paranoid, but I worried about that. Somebody like wrote me and said, I remember that poster in the Greyhound station on 6th Street. And I thought, is that poster a truly etched objective reality? Or was it something that was conjured by me because it maybe is a screen memory that stands for the real feeling in the bus station of runaways who need to call for help? And I have this image in my mind of this poster that has a silhouette of a child and it says, runaways, call for help. And then people are saying, oh my God, I remember that poster. So I don't know if it's real or it's not, but it made me aware maybe of the responsibility of writing these things down that might be shared worlds.
I think that's so interesting. I've never ever thought of that before, where you are in fact not upsetting somebody and portraying someone in a way that they feel is untrue, but that you're actually almost like you're planting new realities in other people's memories. You know what I mean? Like, you're creating a past that didn't even exist and now it's become fact for the rest of the world.
Yeah. Well, I think that like it's the feel of the past is real. It's just that the particularity maybe brings responsibilities with it that became even more clear to me in the wake of it. But I also learned new things afterward. Like, people wrote me and said, you know, oh, after that fight, between the singer of Agnostic Front and some guy in the audience, they all decamped to my house. And then this happened. And then that happened. And, somebody, the New Yorker had said, well, is there any way you can prove that the bass player from the UK Subs, Alvin Gibbs, worked with you at American Rag? And I had no documentation of that. I was a 16-year-old girl, you know, who, like, I'd lied to get the job because I was going to go to college. They didn't want somebody who was going to college to work there, because then you would quit. And this is so long ago. But then somebody wrote me and said, you know, we made a pilgrimage from LA as huge UK Subs fans to visit Alvin Gibbs at his job selling used clothes on Bush Street. I still have his autograph. So sometimes you go, oh, it's not just my dream. It really happened.
That's all so interesting. I mean, we could talk about this the entire time. But I'm going to ask another question about motorcycles. Let's move on to motorcycles. Right. So the first essay in The Hard Crowd, Girl on a Motorcycle, describes a race down the Baja Peninsula in which you crashed your motorcycle and miraculously survived. And in the opening of your novel, The Flamethrowers, a young female artist tries to break a record on her bike and crashes and miraculously survives. There's so much to talk about here, but one thing that I've thought about a lot after reading that essay is the relationship between a person's body moving physically through space and taking risks with one's body, and then being an artist and taking risks with one's imagination. And I was wondering if you could talk about how those two risks interact and inform each other. And I imagine this will naturally lead to some discussions of 70s performance art, which is also something that you write about in The Flamethrowers.
It's such a smart question. I don't have a worked out discourse on risk and what risk is. I only have maybe an instinct that it matters. And I actually remember when I first got the idea to write The Flamethrowers, this was back in 2006. I went to the Getty Museum and saw this exhibit of very early futurist poetry, Parole in Libertà, and this metal book that the futurists had made, like every page of it was metal. And I thought, this is really weird stuff that they made. And it seemed more kind of radical as a gesture than a lot of the contemporary art that I was looking at and trying to think about, which isn't to emphasize throwing shade on what people were making, but more to try to imagine what the environment was like that caused these people to make this other work that went so against the grain of like just this historical moment, like 1913 in Italy. And I wrote something about that. That year, I sort of wrote like a long piece for Art Forum about risk and art. And I just wonder now if that kind of got me thinking. I wouldn't ever say of myself, like, I'm dedicated to artistic risk. Because then it sounds like, well, how do you know, that you're taking a risk? In that regard, in terms of like making art, to the degree that like we are artists as novel writers, I know that it's an art because it's different mind than when I dedicate myself to understanding something in a more expository way. I don't really know what risk is in that regard. I only know that each thing I make, each novel, is a new opportunity to not compromise. And as you make your way through a novel.
A new opportunity to fail. That's how I would have answered that question.
Oh, right. Well, they're related because so compromise means there's something about the form that presents you with an easier solution that isn't that fresh, innovative thing you meant to do and make that was completely new. And each time you go to write a book is a new chance to find a way to be uncompromising, by which I mean sort of like to take risks, you know, the risks that you deem necessary to make something new. That's the only way in which I think risk really matters for art. Can you make something new? In terms of things like, you know, riding motorcycles, which I don't do anymore. So
you don't? Why not?
No, I gave them up because they're dangerous. I, you know, it's odd publishing this book with this essay, Girl on a Motorcycle. You know, it was the first thing that I ever published. I wrote it more than 20 years ago. And I knew I wanted the book to start with it, mostly because it gives an account of what I was up to and who I was before I was a writer. I was not, you know, really writing yet. But I did, I guess I must have, well, I wrote down the details of that, the Cabo 1000. I did that race in 1994, I think. And I wrote the first draft of that essay 4 years later in 1998. So not too much time had passed. And I was able to recall a lot of the details of that race. And there's a lot of technical details about the way that we prepped our bikes and the kinds of things that you needed to prepare for, you know, like which gas stations were going to be open and which closed and why you needed an auxiliary tank and how you connect it to your gas tank and what kind of pump you use and et cetera. And I would not have remembered any of those details had I not written them down. Talking about that essay now, I'm kind of like, you know, in the press, it's like me and motorcycles, like she's daring and risky and all that. And which isn't to sort of let people know, no, actually I'm a poser, but, I gave up riding motorcycles partly for some reasons that I document in that piece to do with just casual death left and right of people that I knew. Some were people who were really skilled riders, but took big, big risks. Like my friend, Sean Crane, who died wheeling up 16th Street in the Mission District. other people were not taking risks, like my friend Lawrence Gill, who was a really beloved machinist who had a shop South of Market, and he owned a Vincent Black Shadow, which is a kind of rare, recherche collectible motorcycle that my father almost also has. Lawrence, from what I understand, was just like on his way to the post office and taking a left, and a car didn't see him and killed him. And it just got to the point where I thought, I'm moving into a more mature phase of my life. I was maybe like, I don't know, 27. And I thought, do I really want to die for this? Like, there are things I want to do. I want to learn how to write novels and do other things. And so I sold my last motorcycle. It was a Kajiva Elephant. And I think I kind of decathected from bikes and then recathected into like classic cars, which gave me, it's not the same thrill, but it might answer to similar needs in my life. I might go back to motorcycles. I mean, I don't know. But for a long time, I lost interest because of the mortality rate.
I mean, one thing I am really, that I think kind of not counteracts the risk-taking, but you were talking about this, just the very technical aspects of preparing for the race. And I do think that that act of preparation is a really fascinating and maybe even transferable kind of skill set from riding a motorcycle in a race to like trying to plan for emergencies when you're writing a novel or something. You know, do you feel like there's some kind of like, it's something like strategy, technique, preparation, I don't know, setting yourself up so that you can perform, if that makes sense.
I never thought about that analogy, but yeah, I think there's something to it. I mean, they might be different, but there are modalities of being and thought when you're in a kind of distracted concentration where you're not aware of the room, for instance, when you're writing, and when you really get into that kind of trance state where the information is kind of, it's almost like it's coming down and it informs your word choice and your syntax and the kinds of images that you conjure for the reader when you could, you know, conjure an array of things. And sometimes when the energy is not there for writing, it can feel arbitrary. Well, I could choose A or I could choose B. But when you're really in that state, you know exactly what to do. And it feels so wonderful. And it doesn't happen every day at all for me. But I think that preparation is being there and knowing when it's starting to happen and kind of knowing how to corral it and sustain it. I don't know. I mean, riding motorcycles, the preparation part is kind of less fun to me, to be honest, than the riding. Like, I was never really patient enough to become a good mechanic. Like, I have a 13-year-old son and I watch him learning about cars, and he knows more about internal combustion and how every part of the car works now than I ever did, because I didn't really have that in me, that kind of person plus machine. I benefited a lot, in full candor, from proximity to other people who had a lot of knowledge about machines. And I've always been a great admirer and even connoisseur of people with machine knowledge, more than I've had machine knowledge myself.
Okay, so that first essay again, Girl on a Motorcycle, sort of sets up a bunch of other essays that follow that, that sort of directly or indirectly investigate what it's like to be female in classically male-dominated spheres. And for example, in the essay Woman in Revolt, you write about the 70s Italian movie Anna, about which I have things to say since I watched part of it last night. It's very hard to come by, and Rachel was actually introducing it at Metrograph, this theater in New York City, and I don't think you can watch it anymore now. It was like last night, it's done, right?
That's right,
Anyways, this movie follows its star, a homeless pregnant woman adopted and documented by male filmmakers. And I'm curious about the attraction as a novelist, a critic, a human, to the inherent challenge or even hostility females face when entering predominantly male worlds, like that of motorcycle racing or skateboard culture or art and revolutionary scenes of the 70s. And then I'm just going to throw this quote of yours into the mix from your essay about the writer Cormac McCarthy. For a long time, I didn't like Western films as a genre because they were boring to me without any women.
It's true. But then just recently, I'm sorry, name drop alert coming up here. The very fascinating writer Jamaica Kincaid, who I've been a fan of for a very long time, she told me to watch Once Upon a Time in the West. It was just so unlikely for Jamaica Kincaid to recommend that movie. I'd seen it many years ago, actually, with men who had convinced me, oh, you got to watch the director's cut. And it was many hours long. And I just thought, well, you know, Claudia Cardinale is in it, but it's still the sphere of male drama, like a kind of orthogonal line between, you know, man and God working out ancient prescriptions for violence. But then I decided that Charles Bronson, you know, I could be Charles Bronson in a way, not in real life.
You could be him or you could beat him.
No, be him. So Charles Bronson plays, or he plays a character who is a kind of redeemer, sort of Satan figure. Like he's been wronged and is coming back to. It's a revenge narrative, but he's only playing that role. And what I'm saying is, when you watch the movie, you can locate subjectivity wherever it is. So the main character is Charles Bronson, and he's doing this revenge thing. And I don't think that the men watching that movie have more in common with that character necessarily than I do. You just kind of go where subjectivity lies. And which is kind of what I think I said next in that McCarthy essay, which is that when I was reading those books in the Border Trilogy, I mean, I read them when I was pretty young, when they first came out, like one by one over the course of their publication history. And then I reread all of them to write that essay. So it was like 1,100 pages of Cormac McCarthy, which at the end of which I kind of felt like I'd guzzled, you know, 11 gallons of chocolate milk or something. It's of sameness of order, but there are a lot of things I admire about Cormac McCarthy. But what I realized was that you go where the main character's subjectivity is going. You do what they're doing with them, and you don't say to yourself, at least I don't, oh, these are male activities, so this can't really interest me until a woman comes along in this book, which may not be for 300 pages, and actually she doesn't have any dialogue, and there's no access to her interiority. But you know, interiority with Cormac McCarthy isn't really what it's about. It's people doing and being, you know. Like I say, they don't have interior psychology. They have canteens and blankets and guns and saddles and horses. I guess though that is historically male terrain, but I think I'm just not constructed that way. Like I don't think to myself that there are barriers and boundaries, and that when I'm a reader, I need to look toward what seems categorically female, because I don't really even know what that is.
It's interesting. I wonder if it's a difference between movies and books. When I hit that line about Westerns and they're not being women in these movies to interest you as much. I don't know. I was thinking how I feel that way maybe about movies more than I do about books. And I wonder if there's something about visual identification or looking for some kind of I don't know, identity. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is, but somehow the visuals to me, if I'm in a book, I don't seem to care, maybe because I'm inside someone's consciousness. And when you're looking at somebody, it's just like a little bit more of a identification barrier, maybe.
I think that's really smart. I think you might be right. Because I was sort of trying to discount, you know, what I'd said in a way, because it's not reflected in my feeling about those novels. And yet, when I think of movies, I do get bored if there aren't any women. And maybe also, you know, socially in life, I get bored if there aren't any women. Like, women are really interesting to me. And, you
Just
know,
variety, variety.
yeah, and they're beautiful and they're clever. And also, like in movies, they're usually really beautiful, you know. And sometimes I can look at women. I don't know. I'm moved by them. I just introduced another movie. Metrograph is doing two screenings that I chose that kind of dovetail with some of the themes in my book. And the other is called The Leather Boys. which was directed by Sidney J. Fury in, I think, 1962. And it's a really amazing movie about the kind of rockers and the mods, the rockers really, of London, who hung out at the Ace Cafe. But it's Rita Tushingham is in it, who was also in Taste of Honey, who was kind of from the sort of British New Wave film era. And it's when she's on screen that, for me, I'm most compelled by. I love that film, but it's women that bring things alive for me somehow visually.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to ask this question somewhat in earnest, but I'm also, because I think your deconstruction of the categories assumed by the question is probably going to be in large part your answer to it. And also because of where you are right now and what you're sitting on and what we're looking at. Sorry, but this is just a question that you just deserve right now.
Okay.
Do you consider yourself to be a Western writer?
Oh, that's so interesting. I've thought about this more and more, which I don't want to give the impression that I think about how I conceive of my own like life as a writer too much. But once in a while, and you know, after you've written a few books, it seems like it's worth giving it some thought, like what the pattern is and who your forebears are and what you're doing. And when I wrote my last novel, The Mars Room, I really felt finally like I actually am a California writer, which is not for me a regional designation. It's merely a place, and all people are from a place. I happen to be from a place, if you can generalize to the state, that is epic, I think, in scope, geographically, the scale of it, the variety, the diversity, the size of our economy. I mean, there's a kind of monstrousness and a beauty to California and its history, even the length and stretch of the state. You know, and Southern California, where I live now, it's if you add together all the different counties of it and the way that it functions in the flux and flow with San Diego and Tijuana, it's like 40 million people. And it's just like unknowably complex. And then the fact that, you know, the state embarked on this prison building project over a period of like 21 years, where they built something like 23 prisons. And cited them in industrial farmland where we grow almost half the food for the United States. All that stuff really fascinates me. And I think about California writers historically who took on the state and its complexities as their subject, such as, for instance, John Steinbeck. And I look at his work and I think about his legacy, and also the poet Philip Levine, who was originally from Detroit, famously, but then relocated to Fresno, California, and wrote a lot of poems that were based in and about the Central Valley and the kind of the some brutalities of the life of migrant farm workers and other people who live in Fresno. And he taught, I don't teach, but I think that Philip Levine sort of shaped a whole school of poets who were raised in the Central Valley and may not otherwise have become poets were it not for the presence there of Philip Levine. And that kind of history excites me and sort of, I guess, makes me want to own the idea of being a Western writer in a way. Does that answer?
Yeah, super interesting. I mean, I guess I would say too, I mean, if you're from the East Coast, as I am, and you go to California, it just doesn't seem possible. Like none of it seems possible. The scale of it doesn't seem possible, you know? And then I always think if this is sort of what your visual everyday is, how could you live on the East Coast? Like, how could you come here? It's almost like it doesn't even exist at all. You know, if your everyday scale is on the California sort of scope of things, but like, do you think it has, I don't know, like, do you feel like there's a tone or like, is there any way that you can kind of, if you see yourself not as a regional writer necessarily, but as from a place, aside from topic, are there other ways that that place has impressed upon you as an artist, would you say?
Maybe. I mean, I'm thinking in real time about this. Like, I'm thinking about this kind of myth of what this literary critic R.W.B. Lewis calls the American Adam, like this Adamic myth of being reborn into newness and the West as a kind of redemption. And I think that that maybe is soaked into the landscape. Not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily, it's not that it survives as an ideology, but as a kind of bravura that is even reflected in, I'm happen to be in Wyoming right now, by the way, which is not that familiar to me. I'm in Northeastern, very rural, high plains. I mean, it's not that high. It's 4,500 feet elevation, but it's all like that here. It's not mountainous. It's just that the ground is really raised up and it's like this strange savanna. And you can go into town and purchase a Stetson hat, and there's a hat shaper in the back of the hat store who will iron it and shape it for you. And you're participating in this kind of myth of what it means to have the front ducked down a little bit on your Stetson, you know? And at the same time, one perhaps can be cognizant of what the myth is. Like in the Border Trilogy, I didn't realize how comical those books are. Cormac McCarthy has them set out for this adventure at a moment when the possibilities in ranch life are closing down. The whole thing is over. It's post-war America. There are not prairie women with victuals who greet them to say their goodbyes. They go to a store and buy canned foods. And then they keep encountering private property and fences. And he was much more kind of saying, the myth that they are trying to pursue is gone, but also, and critically, it never existed to begin with. And I think that maybe there is something about that that's part of the West. Like, you know that you're performing a certain romantic rite, and you also know that you're paying homage to something that was problematic and probably a lie, even in its instantiation.
I mean, maybe this is just how I have justified my own sort of interior gloominess, but I grew up in Maine where it was like cold and gray and rainy all the time. And when I did live in California, I just felt like I couldn't access my imagination. It just felt like there was a Krieg light like on my like inside my brain. The sun was so like this, I felt exposed and just sort of also like I had to go outside and enjoy every sunny minute. You know, I felt like I'd been so programmed by. So maybe what I'm talking about is like less place and more almost like climate. You know what I mean?
Well, I should say, since this is, although, you know, we're all dislocated due to the pandemic. I'm in Wyoming. You're, I believe, in New York City. This is City Arts and Lectures, San Francisco based. And I grew up in the Sunset District, which is not very sunny, despite its name.
It's freezing.
And in the summertime, it is truly freezing there. The winds whip past, you know, big puffs of wet fog are hurled up the street. It's 52 degrees, cold fingers of fog working their way into every part of your clothing. And I was a kid who was out and about, just out all the time. And I just remember freezing my ass off. So my original comfort zone is not the sun. It's that fog, which I have no affection for and no nostalgia for, I will confess.
Okay, this is a question that actually I'm seeing kind of reflected in the questions that are being asked. So this gets to your car, you've now cathected onto cars, and you're in fact pictured on the cover of the Hard Crowd leaning against your Ford Galaxy 500, and you break down, for those who might not know, what certain years and models of vintage cars represents, as machines, but also as containers for identity. I started to think about containers of identity when considering how you decide when your imagination is transfixed by something, what form that interest will take, like book or essay or something else. Like, how do you decide where I'm interested in this thing? Where is it going to go? What car am I buying for this idea?
Your mind works so fast that I was still trying to figure out how to use this analogy between cars and ideas. I don't know. I mean, the car thing is so specific, you know?
Well, I guess just in plain language, what is the, you have an idea, is why is it fiction? Why is it nonfiction? How do you decide? And I mean, I think it's also worth talking about how you in some cases have, like, for example, with prisons and questions of like the industrial prison complex, you have written an essay in the New York Times about it. And then you also wrote a novel that dealt with it, The Mars Room.
Yeah, so that's, I'll go with that one. But first, I just want to say very quickly, you know, about the specificity of cars. There's only certain cars I want. And I really want a 1963 Mercury Marauder, in case anybody has one for sale. And there was one for sale online, supposedly, just last week. And so I wrote the supposed owner through this site, you're like, hey, is this 63 Marauder still for sale? And I got this note back that was, oh, you know, my husband always said, you know, he never wanted a boring car, and he was a big car collector. And then he died. And now I'm staying with my sister in Nebraska because I had to have this surgery. So I'm selling the car. And I thought, huh, this is a really long, specific story. And so I just took a phrase from the note, and I Googled the phrase. And it came up over and over again that with different cars, people had written with interest and had gotten the same letter back. Not that I was going to be gullible enough to buy a 63 Mercury Marauder sight unseen. However, you know, I did inquire about the car. So back to like what I choose. So what, you know, I wrote this, this one example. I don't know. In terms of subject, my mind just doesn't work that way. When I get the idea to write a novel, it's just set. And then I start writing it. And I've only published three so far. I'm writing another now. It's not very many novels.
So you're very, 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 your productivity is really... Just spend less time Googling marauders and actually writing for a little
bit. So there you have it. Each one takes me about 5 years to write. I only brought up that it's three because it's not like there's been enough novels to have a very specific set of, you know, protocols and work habits. Each one is different, but they've all been similar in this one regard, which is that once I decide to write the thing, I write it. And I don't step back and go, actually, this idea seems somewhat flawed. Maybe I'll just put that away and start on something else. I don't do that because I think if I do find the flaw, which I will, because it's inevitable, the flaw is with me and not with the book I've chosen to write. And that's what the process of writing the book is encountering and unknotting and re-knotting and sticking with it. And once you've written one book, the really fantastic thing is that you know you can do it. You know you can do it. There's a deep faith there, even as the process can be, you know, unknown and unpredictable and capricious. But so I wrote that novel, The Mars Room, as a kind of, it's like my contemporary novel. It's about California today, as I see it. In that, it also happens to be about a woman serving two life sentences is in a California women's prison. But it was only after I wrote the book that I took on this assignment to write about the scholar Ruth Wilson Gilmore, who pretty much single-handedly came up with this whole discipline called carceral geography, in thinking about human geography in terms of how the criminal justice system organizes and sorts people in a landscape, and the way that it inheres in and is a product of, you know, the economy of the state, the climate of the state, the political history of the state, the finances, you know, et cetera. It's like everything all at once that she does to try to account for this prison building project in California. And it's all, she's a prison abolitionist. And so that piece was sort of an exploration and explanation of what that is and also what it isn't. And I had to interview a lot of people, Angela Davis, James Foreman, Michelle Alexander, Udi Ofer, who works for the ACLU. And it was a 2-year process writing that piece.
Are you serious?
Which I probably shouldn't brag about. It's a little bit crazy. And part of the reason it took so long to write was that the editors of the New York Times Magazine needed to be totally 100% on board and I guess countenancing every claim I make, sentence by sentence, the whole piece. And that was really a long process with them, but it was worth it because they absolutely came around. And writing something like that for me is a project that I would only undertake after I'd written a novel, when I want to take a break from that and kind of absent myself and dedicate myself totally to someone else's work, humble myself. You know, Ruth Wilson Gilmore knows about history and the Black radical tradition and Marx and the economy and also like activism at the very granular level, door to door, and how things work in Sacramento and how you get bills passed and all this stuff that I don't know about. And so I thought, you know, I'm going to learn everything I can and try to write this piece. That piece has a pretty particular political position and through line to it. And art and the novel, they don't, not in the same way. They aren't about a message. They're about moral doubt and moral complexity.
Do you resist novels that have messages?
I can't think of a really good one that does have a message. I guess The Grapes of Wrath is sort of, you know, considered to be a novel with a message. And maybe that's the part of it that is less enduring. Mm-hmm. But I can't think of a novel I've read where I mean, theoretically, I think I would, because I would reject it in myself. If I were writing to sort of, it's just not the way the mind, I think, of the novelist naturally works. It's an engine whose fuel is curiosity about people and how they rationalize things and the world, which isn't to say it's not apolitical, because I think to write a novel, you have to have a pretty good purchase on the mechanics of the world. And, you know, so you're writing into history and a historical moment. So that is going to be inherently political. But in terms of like the novel being a polemic, no way, because it's just its own special category. And what it gives to us, all of us as readers, is a surplus that you cannot get from the type of work that is much more suited to a message, you know, like an opinion piece in the newspaper.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, this is so interesting now that I'm thinking about it. So like, I suppose an article in the Times maybe is slightly different from an essay, right? Because an essay then could also occupy that kind of less polemical space and that more like curiosity and uncertainty and
for sure
multiplicity of perspectives.
Yeah. I mean, that was just one example about that piece. I haven't written that many personal essays. This book has a few in it, which has been kind of novel for me, but even there, I don't like to sort of put myself in the position of being the moral authority, I guess, in the essay.
Yeah. What kind of positive or negative kind of weight does actually knowing somebody put on you when you're representing them? Or is it actually more weighty to have to represent somebody who you don't know?
Gosh, there's so many different ways to answer this. My first novel, Telextreme Cuba, has like Hemingway is a character in it. And first I wrote him kind of just like I thought Hemingway really was, because it takes place in Cuba and there's a scene in Havana in the Floridita, which is the bar where he famously hung out. And I thought, well, if you're going to, you know, create this real space that's meant to feel real, like a parallel universe that's populated with the historical conditions of the real one in, let's say, 1955, 1956, then Hemingway would go to the bar and have a drink, and he would maybe converse with my character, Christian de la Mazière, who is very much also a real person who I stole from Marcel Ophüls' masterwork, The Sorrow and the Pity. He was this guy who joined the Charlemagne division of the Waffen-SS in August of 1944 and was a fascist, basically. And then I sent him to Cuba to train Cuban revolutionaries, which was my version of a joke. Like, to take the guy who was a right winger and have him training Raoul's column in the mountains. But then it turned out in real life that he had done something somewhat similar, but in the country of Togo. So sometimes you just make these calculations. And I had him meet Hemingway, and I made Hemingway kind of Hemingway-esque, and my husband read it and said, this is so cliched. Like, why don't you just have him waving a marlin around in a, you know, in a hunting vest? And it was a really important moment for me, because what he was saying was, look into the reversal, look into the reversal. So I had Hemingway kind of badgering every man at the bar who says men can't dance. And then he goes off on this whole thing about a lost French tradition of the poet diplomat. And he's effeminate and diffusive. And then it turns out in real life, what I learned from Ken Burns and Lynn Novick's recent documentary about Hemingway is that he wanted his wife, Mary, to call him Catherine, and he would call her Pete. And his mother had dressed him as a girl from the time when he was 2 years old, which isn't to say that I just had razor sharp extrasensory insights, but sometimes the reversal has power to it. And if the person is a publicly known figure, you're allowed to do it, you know, so watch out.
Yeah,
you live it.
I'm watching out right now. I mean, I'm always a little bit paranoid about everything. So,
but writing about
now, I just have something specific. Yeah. No. Anyway, sorry. Go on.
But if it's real people that I knew, you know, I would be much more careful. I mean, I haven't written about real people so much in fiction. They're usually amalgams that have undergone what for me is a kind of sacred process of art, where they become fixed into the sort of organic potion of the book. And in that sense, they're always built of multiple parts and only exist in the book. And somebody couldn't say like, oh, that's a Ramona Clef and that this person is that and this person is that. I've never written a novel like that. And if I write about real people in those essays, I've mostly, you know, gotten their approval to do it.
Okay, I feel like we have time for one more question. It's not a mean question. It's just a curiosity that
is this from you or yeah?
No, this is from me. I'm asking this question. I mean, maybe I should say it's somebody else in case you don't like it. It's definitely someone from the audience asked this question. No, I have spent a lot of time looking at the cover of your book, which everyone, I keep talking about the cover of your book. The interior of the book is also so exquisite, but the image on the cover is really, really so striking of you leaning against your car. And anyways, I kind of want you to pretend that you're like you, but like not you, critic, looking at this image with your visual critical sense. And there's this person leaning against the car, and the right hand is relaxed and the left hand is clenched. Have you looked at this photo as carefully as I have?
Perhaps not, but I believe you, because I mean, you know, when you're performing a relaxed state, when a photographer is taking a picture of you, as I'm sure you very well know, it's not a relaxed experience to have your photo taken. I've always thought of it as a miniature execution. I got that from Jason, my husband, you know, and also like a little piece of your soul is really stolen. But one does it. That picture was taken right before my novel, The Flamethrowers, came out. And one thing I don't like about it is that I now have a much better paint job on that car with this beautiful rainbow flake lacquer. So, you know, it doesn't have that in that picture. But I think the photographer suggested posing against the car. I mean, people have said, oh, you were mimicking Joan Didion standing in front of her Corvette Stingray. No, I was just sort of being directed and told to stand there. And I did. And I can see that she's also posing in front of her car. And I think she looks a lot cooler and sexier than I do. But I will say that she's standing in front of a brand new car, whereas I'm standing in front of a 50-year-old car. And so what would be the equivalent of posing in front of a brand new Corvette Stingray today? It would be like posing in front of a Tesla or something. It's not that cool, you know?
Definitely not.
Even though those cars do look cool because they have that molded fiberglass body. But in terms of me being a critic looking at that image,
I'm half that all the time, and I'm not that comfortable with it.
I'm not that comfortable with the whole thing of putting a picture of myself on the cover of my book. That was, the publisher wanted to do that. My editor wanted to do that. I wanted to be like, you know, James Wood and Lydia Davis. FSG has these essay collections where it's just like a green field with the typeset of the name, or with James Wood, it's like a cobalt blue book with the typeset of the name. And I was lamenting to a friend, oh, I didn't get that treatment, like the very literary, just the essays. And so it was a man, and he said something funny like, those people can't drive as fast as well as you can, or something like that. But it took a minute for me to come around to the idea of being on the cover of the book. And in a way, it's why I chose the epigraph that I did by Clarice Lispector when she says, you know, what is it?
I'll read it for you. I got it right
here. Yeah, why don't you?
Yeah, sure.
If you don't mind.
It is, what others get from me is then reflected back onto me, the form that and forms the atmosphere called I.
Yeah, I think when I reread that, I really felt like it did something to capture my own doubt and lack of comfort with being on the cover of my book, and also the way in which I'm quite aware that it's meant to sort of steer the reader, book consumer, to have some idea of who I am. And I'm always kind of aware of that and then reincorporating that into who I actually am. So what Clarice Lispector said just seemed so apt.
I mean, I will say that I bet if either Lydia Davis or James Wood had a photo that looked as good as this one, they would have used it on their cover, correct? But then also I would just say it feels very... it's artifactual. You know what I mean? I just sort of feel like it really captures, it's not just about you, obviously you are on the cover, but I feel like it's part of the artifact archival kind of nature of this collection.
It's true. I mean, it's 20 years worth of essays, and the picture was taken, I think, in 2012, and now we're in 2021. So it's kind of meeting halfway between the very young me in the first essay and, you know, the very, you know, jaded older me right now. So there you have it.
There you have it.
You've been listening to writer Rachel Kushner in conversation with Heidi Julewitz. This program was recorded on April 29th, 2021. These broadcasts are produced by City Arts and Lectures in association with KQED Public Radio, San Francisco. Executive producers are Kate Goldstein-Breyer and Holly Mulder-Wallen. Director of Communications and Design is Alexandra Washkin. Production and Communications Assistant is Juliet Gelfman-Rondazzo. The Post-Production Director is Nina Thorson. The Sydney Goldstein Theater Technical Director, Steve Eckerd. House Manager, Lucy Faulkner. The Recording Engineer is Jim Bennett. Theme music composed and performed by Pat Gleason. The founding producer is Sydney Goldstein. City Arts and Lectures programs are supported by grants for the arts of the San Francisco Hotel Tax Fund. Additional funding provided by the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, the Mimi and Peter Hawes Fund, the Bernard Osher Foundation, and the Friends of City Arts and Lectures. Support for recording and post-production of City Arts and Lectures is provided by Robert Mailer Anderson and Nicola Miner. To attend a live program, see who is coming next, or find out more about our podcast, visit our website at cityarts.net. That's cityarts.net.
Special thanks to Anne Oyama for making our programs possible as we shelter in place at home.